The single bullet theory is all about what it does after it emerges from Kennedy's neck. Does it remain intact? Is it deflected? What happens to its velocity?
How fast was it going? That's important to know. What kind of damage can we expect it to do to another gunshot victim, such as Conley, or to the car?
In these 3 feet, the space between Kennedy and Conley, lie the answers that prove or disprove the single bullet theory.
Come on, guys, Google it before you name your band. That was a band called Single Bullet Theory, formed in Philadelphia in the year 2000. But why would you choose a name for your band that had already been used by another band that had a major label record deal and videos on MTV? The original Single Bullet Theory formed in Richmond, Virginia in 1976. They were originally called X-Breed. Hey, guys! You could have used that name. Because the band didn't go anywhere until they changed it to Single Bullet Theory. X-Breed featured Dennis Madigan on drums, Michael Maurice Garrett on vocals, and Frank Daniel on guitar. They were soon joined by another guitar player, Gary Holmes, and a bassist named Davey Wynn. And I guess it's when those two guys joined that X-Breed became Single Bullet Theory. Now, the single bullet theory, or magic bullet theory, as it is commonly called by critics, was introduced by the Warren Commission in its investigation into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And the theory is that an inch and a half long, copper-jacketed, lead-core, Mannlicher Carcano rifle bullet fired from the sixth floor of the Texas Schoolbook Depository passed through President Kennedy's neck and went into Governor Connally's chest, then through the governor's wrist, and embedded itself in the governor's thigh. That means that this one bullet cut through 15 layers of clothing, 7 layers of skin, approximately 15 inches of muscle tissue. It also struck a necktie knot, destroyed 4 inches of the governor's rib, and shattered his radius bone. The bullet was then found on a gurney in the corridor at Parkland Memorial Hospital after the assassination. The Warren Commission concluded that that gurney was the gurney that had carried Governor Connally into the hospital. The bullet then became a key exhibit for the Warren Commission. Its copper jacket was completely intact, and the nose of the bullet appeared normal, but the tail was compressed laterally on one side. So many people have questioned whether or not it was possible for that one bullet to have traveled on that trajectory and caused that much damage and then shown up mysteriously, if you want to, you know, project mystery on it, in that condition on that gurney. What many people seem to be unaware of is that the actual front seat had been taken out of the limousine, and Governor Connally was seated in a jump seat, the edge of which was 3 inches inboard and possibly 4 inches lower than President Kennedy. So when you see these crazy diagrams showing this impossible trajectory for this magic bullet, those diagrams were created under the assumption that Governor Connally was seated in the original front seat of the limo, not the lower jump seat. Myself, I definitely believed in elements of the conspiracy when I was younger, but I've read several books and done enough research over the years to convince myself by this time that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone and assassinated President Kennedy. I've been to Dealey Plaza, I've been inside the Schoolbook Depository, and I think anyone who has looked out that window or stood down in the street where the limo was and looked up at the window, you know how close together it all actually was and what an easy shot that was for somebody like Oswald who was trained as a sniper with a rifle. It would have been an easy shot for someone who wasn't trained. It was very close. Another thing to consider is that President Kennedy was wearing a back brace that held him upright, straight up. He simply could not duck down out of the line of fire. He was held up, an easy target. Anyways, back to the band, Single Bullet Theory. Surrounded by cover bands in Richmond, they decided to play originals. They recorded an EP in 1977. Then bassist Davey Wynn quit. Frank Daniels switched from guitar to bass. They got a new guitar player named Mud Herman. That EP was released by Artifacts Records, and the cover of the EP is pretty neat. It has the Kennedy assassination, the image of the Kennedy assassination, but drawn on an Etch-a-Sketch.
Black, but I am.
Anyways, after the EP, that new guitar player Mud Herman quit, and Frank Daniel, who had switched to bass, switched back to guitar. But then singer Michael Maurice Garrett started playing rhythm guitar. The EP got good reviews from Trouser Press and fanzines around the country. The band started traveling to New York City to play gigs, including opening for Patti Smith, but they still had day jobs, so they were just driving in a van on weekends, returning back home to Richmond in time to go to work on Monday morning. Another guitar player then joined the band, Mark Lewis, and Frank Daniel again switched back to bass. At this point, Single Bullet Theory were invited to be on a compilation of new bands that was going to be released by Planet Records and distributed by Elektra Asylum. The record is called Sharp Cuts, and the subtitle for the album was New Music from American Bands, and it included songs by former Blondie bassist Gary Valentine, his band The No, and also Chris Stamey's band The DBs. So Single Bullet Theory are invited to be on this record. They go to Washington, D.C. to No Evil Studios, record a song called Keep It Tight. The band thought it sounded great, but the powers that be in L.A. decided that it was too, quote, hot to fit with the other songs on the album, so it was remixed. The album comes out, gets good reviews, including by Dave Marsh and Rolling Stone, and he said Keep It Tight was the best song on the record. Planet Records actually decided to release that song as a single, so at that point, the band had to record a B-side. But foreshadowing things to come, they didn't have a good experience recording the B-side, clashed with the producer, etc. But it was at this point that Single Bullet Theory accepted an offer to go out on tour with the Pretenders in Canada, opening for the Pretenders. The Pretenders booking agency was impressed by those shows in Canada, set up a series of small tours in the U.S. for Single Bullet Theory, opening for the Ramones and Simple Minds. Now they've got major label interest. Mike Curb, he had Curb Records distributed by Warner Brothers. He was interested in signing the band. That didn't work out, but Paul Atkinson, who had been in the Zombies, was an A&R guy for Columbia Records. He wanted to sign the band. There was interest from Dave Edmonds in possibly producing the band, so they recorded a demo in New York City, 5 songs, sent it to Edmonds. Apparently Edmonds passed and then Columbia Records passed. At this point, Mark Lewis and Frank Daniel both leave the band. A guy named Mick Muller joins the band on bass. Michael Maurice Garrett, the singer, starts playing more guitar, and at this point they enlist a keyboard player named Barry Fitzgerald, and that's going to have a pretty big effect on the band's sound. So they're sick of waiting for a record company to finally pull the trigger on signing the band. So they booked themselves some time at Alpha Audio in Richmond and record a 9-song demo tape. They do end up going out on tour with the Pretenders while shopping that tape around to record labels. 2 big dates happen at the Palladium and the Ritz in New York City, and record company people are there. And finally, the band ends up signing with Nemperor Records, which was distributed by CBS. And Nemperor was also the home to the Romantics and Steve Forbert at the time. So Nemperor enlists producer Rob Freeman, who had just co-produced Beauty and the Beat for the Go-Go's. He's unfamiliar with the band, and the band and the producer, they really, their vision for the record doesn't really match up. Ends up not being a great experience for the band. The album was recorded at North Lake Studios outside of New York City. The band's really not happy with the end result, and Nemperor Records also, they approve a remix, so Tony Bongiovi is brought in. He remixes the record at the Power Station in New York. The band is still unhappy with the record. Apparently, it didn't sound like what they wanted it to sound like. It's a very well-produced record. Apparently, they didn't want a very well-produced, slick record, but that's what they got. Vocalist Michael Maurice Garrett said, quote, "It's a pop album. We're not a pop band." The album was supposed to be released in November of 1981, but it was delayed until January of 1982. Single Bullet Theory signed with a booking agency, and they went out on the road, opening for Adam Ant, 28 dates across the U.S. with Adam Ant. So the album comes out January 19th, 1982. Keep It Tight is the first single, rises to number 78 on Billboard, so it cracks the top 100. Single Bullet Theory shot a video for the song. It got a little bit of airplay on MTV. This is the early stages of MTV. The band go out on a headlining tour of clubs, but they're really getting no promotion from their record label, so this is a familiar story. It never makes any sense why the label invests money in a band and then really doesn't try to promote the band very much at all. They kind of just let Keep It Tight die on the vine, even though it's a great song, and there's just move on to the next single. They put a little bit more money into a video for Hang On To Your Heart. Actually, that's the only song on the record the band did not write themselves, but this is the one the label wants to promote. So the band shoots a video for the song, and then the single is never actually released. The song never actually comes out as a single. The video got a little bit of airplay, not enough. The band was supposed to go out on tour with Dave Edmunds, but they're looking at this. They've got no tour support from the label. They're going to have to pay for it themselves. They're just going to lose money on the tour. They're not getting promotion. The single hasn't even been released as a single. So they've got a video, but no single. At this point, Gary Holmes quits the band, and Frank Daniel comes back and rejoins the band. Booking agency wants them to start playing clubs again. They're thinking, shouldn't we start writing our next album? But the record company doesn't really seem to care about the next album. They're writing songs, recording demos. The record company makes an offer. They will pay for the recording of the record, but the band will have to pay for the producers. So Single Bullet Theory start talking to other record companies, trying to find a new label that will actually support them and what they're doing. They don't really see the kind of interest they were hoping for, and they break up.
Yeah.
So it's a familiar story. Young, inspired band, just run through the music industry meat grinder, unappreciated, unsupported. Kind of like the music industry says, we'll sort of roll the dice on this band just in case some kind of a fluke happens and they have some success, but we're not really going to invest anything in it. But then, of course, if by random chance they become successful basically on their own, then we'll get to reap the benefits. Seems like that's what happened a lot in the 70s and 80s. Record labels would just roll the dice on a lot of different bands, invest as little money as possible, then 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 hits, and now the record company can keep all the money and cut their losses on the rest. So here's the thing. Single Bullet Theory had a bad experience with record labels and the music industry, and apparently they didn't like their album. They thought it was too polished and too poppy. They thought of themselves as a punkier, artsier, more underground sounding band. But I think that the album is great. Now, a lot of this might be retrospective, looking back. You know, at the time, it was a different world. At the time, they had a different vision for what they wanted to do. But now, from my perspective, you know, having gotten into this record in the 90s, long after all of this was over, I love this record. And I think the production is great. I think the record sounds awesome. Kind of fits in the power pop realm a little bit. It kind of fits in the AOR realm a little bit. It definitely doesn't fit in like the alternative indie rock, which is seems like what the how the band thought of themselves as an underground band. And the EP is much more like that, like a post-punk kind of art rock kind of thing. So it's very interesting that they go into the studio with Rob Freeman and they come out with this tight, slick, really good sounding record for the time, and they hate it, which, you know, they should be very proud of this album, but it wasn't their goal, it wasn't their vision, it wasn't what they wanted to do, it wasn't how they wanted to express themselves, it wasn't the art they wanted to present to the world as their work. But just as a piece of work from the time, as a record by a band in the early 80s, it sounds great, the songwriting is great, it's just great for what it is. So it's interesting to look at that dichotomy of how the band wanted it to sound and what the band wanted to present to the world. But what ends up being presented is a very professional sounding record that is very impressive for what it is, but what it is not what they wanted it to be. Okay, enough talk. Let's hear this record by Single Bullet Theory. This is a self-titled record. It has a great album cover. Different colored water pistols. Plastic, kind of transparent water pistols. The record begins with the song Keep It Tight, a newly recorded version different from the version that was on Sharp Cuts. And if you compare this version to previous versions, it's definitely more produced. Apparently, the band wasn't necessarily happy with being what they might have felt was overproduced. But to my ears, this is a far superior version of the song because I love the production. And it's sort of a power pop classic, but the organ sound and like the sax solo, there are elements of the song that push it into kind of a Dire Straits Walk of Life kind of arena or something. To me, it doesn't quite fit into the power pop or the AOR kind of box. It's more of a 80s pop kind of new wavy kind of song. It was a great single for 1982, and it should have been a hit.
Bye. before I go, there's some things you just gotta know. Keep it tight. Keep it tight. You gotta keep it tight.
Okay, the second song on the record by Single Bullet Theory, song called Slide Away. I love the production on this song. I think it sounds great. I can't imagine really why the band couldn't get behind this kind of tight, thick, vibrant sound. There are elements of new wave and AOR in this song. Great soaring guitar chords. This is just a compact, confident sounding song. Songwriting and production just coming together and working. And I find it unfortunate that the band members couldn't be proud of and appreciate what was created here, because this is excellent. third song on the record, another great single, and the video they made was of higher quality than their first video, Keep It Tight. It's a song called Hang On To Your Heart. Definitely a pop song. Not as epic as Slide Away, but still sounds really good, and the melody is really good, so I like this song a lot. Fourth song on the album is called Blink of an Eye. Slide Away sounds better, but I like everything about this. It's a very well-written song, decently produced. Can't really complain about anything about this song. It's very, very catchy, very well done in every respect.
Fast.
The next song on the record is called Das Mädchen, and this one is back to the quality of Slide Away. This is perfect production for an excellent song. Very effective melodic song with killer hooks. I love this song, and like I said, I think it is perfectly produced. It sounds amazing. All right, we flip the record over and we get to the first song on side two called There Is the Boy. This is an upbeat song. Not as good as any of the songs on side one, in my opinion, but still a really fun song to listen to. I like it. It's not the song's fault that the songs on the first side are all so great. So this is a good one. Check it out. There Is the Boy.
There is the boy with his plans all laid, with a girl in the middle with mistakes on me.
Okay, up next, another upbeat, kind of generic song called Too Hot to Handle. The song itself is as generic as the title, but it's still good. These first two songs on side two are kind of lacking in the intricate melodies that we got on side one. Maybe slight elements of filler, but this is an album, this is what I do on this overlooked series, is this is an album that is good all the way through. So that's the kind of records that I cover with these overlooked episodes, is an album that most people don't know about and have never heard, and it's a strong, high-quality record all the way through. Alright, the third song on side two, a very new wave sounding song called Neutralizer. This is the worst song on the album, but it's not a bad song. As I previously stated before the last song, every song on this record is good in my opinion, but this is my least favorite song.
Rocking up inside my head. She's got a neutralizer.
second to last, we get a song called Anxious. This is one of the band's early songs, and this is a good one. I know that the band themselves were more fond of the earlier version of this song that they recorded themselves, but you gotta make it sound like the rest of the album. And as I've said earlier on the episode, I believe that Robert Freeman did an excellent job producing this record, and it turned out great to my ears. So this is the second to last song on the record by Single Bullet Theory. It's called Anxious. Alright, we've made it to the last song on the album. I hope you've enjoyed this record by Single Bullet Theory. I know I do. Let me know what you think. rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com. You can comment on the blog page for the episode. You can send me a message at Facebook. You can comment when I post the episodes on Facebook. So there's lots of ways to give me feedback or, you know, just let me know you're out there listening. Anyways, the last song on the record is called Dead End Again, and finally, on side two, we reach the melodic heights of the first side. And this song is better produced, sounds better than the rest of side two as well. This is a great song, just excellent songwriting, excellent performances, excellent production, great mix, crisp, tight, aggressively awesome. So check it out. This is the last song on the record Single Bullet Theory. It's called Dead End Again.
Dead End Again. my prime. Just like a promise I forgot to keep. Another daydream team I could put to sleep. Read my chapter of accidents. Your dreams have died. I played it out without compromise.
So there you have it, Single Bullet Theory, overlooked record from 1982, a very strong album from a band with lots of potential, but the music industry and the record-buying public let them down, and they broke up without recording a second album. They were working on it, they were working towards it, and I wish that a second album had happened for this band. They deserved it, they were talented, they might not have been pleased with how their record turned out, but lots of songwriting talent on display for sure on this album. And it's a tragedy that the band were let down and broke up, and we didn't get to hear more great material from Single Bullet Theory. So I hope you enjoyed this album as much as I do, and like I said, let me know, keep in touch. And there you have it. This was the third volume of the Overlooked series, talking about Single Bullet Theory from 1982.
Follow the closed doors into the new team. I'm out.
So we're doing these segments where you listen to old records, and I put them at the end of episodes, and I was thinking we should have some kind of a theme song or an introduction for it. And I was thinking it could go something like this.
Dan Rock!
What do you think?
No.
No? Come on, sing it with me.
Dan Rock!
Sing it.
Dan Rock!
Okay, I'm here with my daughter, and she's 13 years old. She's in Generation Z. She's not even a millennial. She's younger even than a millennial. So what we're going to do is, over the course of I don't know how long, she's going to listen to an album, and we're going to get her thoughts on it, and we're going to kind of go chronologically. And so the best place to start was the Beatles, obviously. Was going to have her listen to the White Album at first, but then I thought that was too long and convoluted, and so I chose Revolver for some reason, and then as we were listening to the album, I thought maybe I chose the wrong one, but people love Revolver. The problem with Revolver is that the American version, which is the version that I have on vinyl, is missing some of the key songs that were on that album in the rest of the world, so we listened to a couple of those songs as well. Now we're going to hear what my 13-year-old daughter, a member of Generation Z, thinks after her first time listening to Revolver. She knew some of the songs already, but this is her first time to just listen to the full album as a record. Just sit down and listen to it, and she took some notes, and now she's going to give us her thoughts. I thought it would be interesting to hear the perspective of a 13-year-old on this music. As we're going to go, we'll cover some really, really famous albums that she's not really familiar with, and I think it'll be interesting to hear her thoughts on these records. And so, take it away, daughter.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay.
Well, so, what did you know about the Beatles before you started listening to this album?
I knew that they were a band. I thought they were from, like, the 80s or something.
Oh, no. The 80s.
Not the 80s, more like the 70s.
Right.
But, well, they basically...
They broke up in 1970. They're from the 60s. Basically, mm-hmm. Everything they did basically was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So, which, you know, since you were born in 2006, the 60s seems like very ancient history to you. It happened before I was even born, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, I just knew that they were a thing, but I also knew popular songs and then other songs, but I didn't really know that the other songs existed. I just knew that like I knew what they were, but I didn't know what they were.
Yeah. Well, I've tried to tell you about the Beatles at numerous times, but
mm-hmm.
It depends, I guess, on your level of interest in this. See, the Beatles are very important in the history of rock and roll because they really kick-started the concept of people writing their own songs and of a whole band of guys that all wrote songs and sang their own material, and then they really inspired pretty much everything that came afterwards was inspired by them in terms of people being in bands and making records, and they were very important in the history of popular culture and rock and roll and music and everything. So
they were on a record label, but they still wrote their own songs, right? Or
yeah,
were
they?
Yeah.
Yeah, mostly before the Beatles. Well, there were guys like Buddy Holly and people that wrote their own songs, but most popular music before the Beatles, other people wrote the songs and then other people sang them.
Yeah.
So the Beatles were a big change. And they also made a lot of people who, you know, they inspired a lot of kids to say, hey, I can do that. I could do that too. Where people didn't really look at Elvis and say, I could be Elvis.
Yeah, I was going to say, Elvis didn't write any of his songs, did he?
No, he didn't.
No.
And he seemed like, no kid was watching TV and saying, hey, I could be Elvis. He seemed like unattainable. But when for some reason, kids saw the Beatles on TV and thought, hey, I could do that too. That's really cool. And so they really, and we were just talking about generations, the baby boom generation. That's called the baby boom because right after World War II, a lot of babies were born, and they all became teenagers right when the Beatles came out.
Mm-hmm.
So there were more teenagers than ever in history, and their parents had money, so they could buy a lot of records and buy instruments. Plus, think about it, before the internet, before video games, before there wasn't even that much on television,
one thing they could do is learn to play guitar and be in a band. They didn't have a lot of other distractions, so that was like a big hobby. So what did you think of the record? If you just think of it as an album, what did you think of it?
Well, it seemed like there was a lot more hard work like put into the album than there are in a lot of albums that are like now albums.
Yeah, right.
And also all of the songs on the album kind of had like the same structure, kind of, it seemed like, which a lot of songs now don't have the same structure, but it seemed like they just had verse and then pre-chorus and then chorus and then maybe pre-chorus again and then another verse.
Right.
Which isn't really how any songs work anymore. I mean, some do, but most of them aren't very, like, repetitive like that, kind of.
Okay.
And also, all the song names have something very obvious to do with the song. Like, Good Day Sunshine, or whatever it's called.
Right.
Like, it says that over and over again in the song. Yeah.
Okay, and yeah, well, like, your favorites, 21 Pilots, Billie Eilish, they sometimes have song titles that they don't even say it in the song, right?
Like, Illumino, the Billie song never says that,
right,
ever. That's not even a word. It has nothing to do, I mean, not metaphorically, it has nothing to do with the song, so.
Right.
And also, the songs aren't about something stupid. I mean, like, Yellow Submarine, that's kind of, I don't know. But a lot of them aren't about something stupid, and a lot of the songs today are just about, like, the same exact thing.
Like, what? What do you mean? Like, about what?
I don't know. Just a lot of songs now have, like, the same exact lyrics and stuff, and then in these, like, I forgot which song, but he was, like, well, it was that, like, sleeping one.
I'm only sleeping, yeah.
Yeah, and he was talking about being in a river or something. That's not in any of the other songs,
yeah, he
obviously.
Says float upstream, which is weird. You usually float downstream.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's John Lennon. It's a play on words, you know, or it's John Lennon was into, like, imagery like that.
Yeah, see, like, just one line of that song was, like, a play on words. And also all of the songs were high-pitched, like, most of them were pretty high-pitched, not a lot of them were low. I don't think any of them were, like, super low, like, all of them.
Yeah, I think, like, they were they're in a major key, they're upbeat,
they're all in the same sort of key, too.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't sound the same, but they're in the same, like, ish key. Yeah, that's all I had for notes, I think. Wait, let me see. Oh, also there were lots of harmonies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have everybody singing, and their voices sound good together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they sound very similar.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of. Okay, do you want to go song by song then?
Sure.
And so we listened to the American version, but then we also played I'm Only Sleeping and Andrew Bird Can Sing, which are two great John Lennon songs that they took off. Capitol took them off the album when they put it out in the U.S. So.
Okay, so for Taxman, I noticed it's, like, the most repetitive song on the album because it says Taxman over and over and over and over again.
Right.
And the melody isn't very repetitive at all, but then the lyrics, it just keeps going over and over again, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But,
so,
yeah.
Did you like the song or not really? Or
it was okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't hate it.
It was like one of the Beatles' heavier guitar songs for the time.
Yeah, there were like two songs that were just really heavy on guitar.
Yeah.
But then like also like repetitive, I don't know. Yeah. And then for Eleanor Rigby, I noticed that the melody is more repetitive and it's a pretty song. Unlike Taxman is more like loud. And it's not like obnoxiously loud, but it's more in your face than Eleanor Rigby was, and it was more metaphoric than Taxman, kind of. It seemed like Taxman was kind of a more fun song, and then Eleanor Rigby was kind of like more like, I don't know, just more artsy of a song.
Right. And sad.
Yeah. I mean, the melody wasn't sad, but then I bet if I listened closer to the lyrics, it would sound sad.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And then Love You Too, well, before I even listened to the song, the title, the two, only has one O, which is right. Weird. Which is weird.
Because he would love you to do something instead of saying, I love you also. Oh. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. I said it sounds sort of Egyptian-y, which, because I couldn't find any other word to use, because of, the guitar thing.
The sitar.
Sitar. Guitar.
Egyptian-y. Yeah, sitar's not an Egyptian instrument, I guess. It's more of a Middle Eastern or Indian instrument. But, yeah, I mean, I know what you mean.
And also, it was kind of boring, because it just kept, going. It just kept going. Nothing really happened. Yeah.
Well, I did an episode called Worst of the Beatles where me and Brian sort of picked the five worst Beatles songs, and that was one of my picks for one of the worst Beatles songs.
Yeah.
I hate the sitar songs.
And then for Here, There, and Everywhere, I just said boring.
Really? You thought it was boring?
And decent melody. The melody wasn't, bad, but I just said it was boring. And then for Yellow Submarine, I said it is kind of sing-songy.
Yeah.
And it's very repetitive. Not as repetitive as Taxman, but, kind of getting there. And I don't know if it's very metaphoric, but it could be. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was...
Right, if you're thinking about what the hell are they talking about?
Yeah.
Are they actually talking about anything, or is it just nonsense?
See, I mean, yeah. Well, it said that the whole album is based off of LSD, so maybe they were in a yellow submarine while they were hallucinating. Yeah. That would make sense.
They wanted a song for Ringo to sing.
Yeah.
And they would do songs like that were just kind of nonsense. Just fun, funny, weird, odd songs with different kinds of imagery. So,
And then for She Said, there were some darkish lyrics, but it was still a happy melody. And it was almost kind of a sing-songy melody, but it was still yeah.
And there's great guitar in that one.
Yeah.
I love that song, but what do you, do you like it or...
I don't really remember that song, actually, but, and then for Good Day Sunshine, it had a positive-ish melody, it was one of the most, it was also kind of sing-songy just because of the lyrics. The melody wasn't exactly, I don't know, but...
So is sing-songy a bad thing?
No.
No?
Not necessarily. If the whole album was, them singing... Mary Had a Little Lamb, that would be in a bad way, but,
Yeah.
No. But, yeah, it was also very repetitive. And then for No One, that was my favorite song on the album.
Interesting.
And it's a pretty song, and it's not very slow or sad, but it's kind of, melancholy-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, because it's, dark, but at the same time. I mean, some of the lyrics... Or some of the, melody is kind of minor, but then a lot of it is major. So, yeah, and then it still had kind of a happy melody. And then I Want to Tell You had a lot of harmony in it, and interesting piano, because it was still, organized, but it also went all over the place. Some of the chords were minor, and then the singing was, in a way different chord than the piano at some points.
Mm-hmm.
And then... Forgot to Get You Into My Life, it didn't have as many instruments as, other songs did during the verses in the beginning. In the chorus, there was, a bunch of instruments, but then, yeah. And it was sort of louder and more in your face. It was, really loud, kind of.
Yeah, Paul belts it out on that one.
Yeah. It's louder than Taxman, I would say. But, yeah. And then Tomorrow Never Knows, there was a lot of insanity. And it was more jazzy because there was a lot of, improvising and a bunch of just weird stuff. And then I'm Only Sleeping had pretty harmonies and backup singing. and it was slightly more low-pitched than the other songs, it seemed like. And then Your Bird Can Sing. Usually singing is, like, the most repetitive thing in the song, but, like, the instruments are more repetitive, kind of, in that song.
You mean that guitar lick? I love that guitar part.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's it.
So you already answered one question I was going to ask, which, what was your favorite song? And it was For No One.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting that that was your favorite. So what's your overall opinion of the album? Maybe all the albums we should have you rank, that, like, give it a 1 out of 10. Like, what would you, as a whole, like, as a complete...
Maybe a 6.25.
Okay.
I don't know.
And yeah, as we go, I guess one thing I'll ask you is if which album you like better.
Yeah.
You know, as we go along listening to different bands.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this was the best representation of the Beatles to play for you, like the best album to pick. Probably not. I don't know. But, you know, we were talking about how the Beatles, a lot of their songs are singles, a lot of their... Did you just burp?
Yes.
it probably would have been more fun to make you listen to the White Album, but it's really long with a lot of songs. Mm-hmm. So, do you think you're ever going to want to listen to this album again?
I guess it depends on the song. I probably wouldn't listen to, like, Taxman or, like, whatever it's called. Oh, Love You Too again. But
right.
I don't know.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. The louder songs seemed to be kind of the more boring songs sometimes, which is weird-ish, but...
It must be your taste. I guess. It's your taste. Yeah. Did you enjoy listening to this?
Yeah.
Do you understand its place in history? Like, do you have any, do you have reference for that? Like, do you understand what the Beatles meant? And
yeah,
for people your age, rock and roll really doesn't have much prevalence in the culture. Mm-hmm. But that's why I think it'll be interesting as we go forward for you to listen to different albums that were really famous and important to my generation and the generation before me, and see what you think, see what your reaction is to them. So, all right, so that was The Beatles' Revolver, and next time, we'll see what we listen to next time.
Your day breaks, your mind aches, you find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up, she takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her, and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think she needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You stay home, she goes out, she says that long ago she knew someone, but now he's gone, she doesn't need him. Your day breaks, your mind aches, there will be times when all the things she said will fill your head. You won't forget her. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years.
I'll be back.